things, brought us great programming and things like that, we started moving towards more of a professional type of a broadcasting environment for the non-coms. So this is where we get this conflict that arises. What is the definition? And still, we probably haven't resolved that. You see, how many guys have like a university station that's run by the students? Yeah, see, so there's your radio laboratory model. How many NPR guys do we have in here? Yeah, so there's the other side of the fence, exactly. Okay, so in 1972, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting then seeks to standardize NCE stations along the particular model of the more business professional line. And of course, the commission went along with it in 1978, and the question is how much money was involved there? Don't know. But the Class Ds wind up being phased out. Basically, you either move or you're done. The other thing that contributed to this also was the proliferation of translators in the 1980s and 1990s. And I think it's fair to say even in the 2000s, we've had a considerable amount of proliferation just because of the AMs as well. Now, an interesting thing that shows up in 1987, once again, the People's Republic of Illinois, is WTRA goes on the air in Springfield, Illinois. Does anybody know the history of this, by the way, what happened was taking place? Well, there was a gentleman that was of African descent that lived in a housing project in Springfield, and they actually started, the police were actually engaging in thuggery, apparently, in Springfield. And so I guess more things change, they stay the same. But he goes on the air and starts a one-watt station, and basically because he's got the public exposure, the commission declines to shut him down because of the PR that it would cause, and he winds up getting the police to back off. We also see in Berkeley in 1993, we get Free Radio is founded. But we really start taking off with things in the 1996 Telecom Act. Anybody remember what happened in 1996 in the Telecom Act? Multiple ownership. Okay. Prior to that, you were severely limited in how many stations you could have. Now we're up to where you can have eight in a market. Okay. And that came about as in the 1996 Telecommunications Act. So now we start seeing a lot of consolidation in stations. And as a result of some of the consolidation, people are saying the programming is not educational, it's not tailored to the communities, et cetera. So micro radio takes to air because we get a lot of smaller stations, electronics are available. 1998, the first LPFM proposals are filed, which basically takes us back to the Class D again. 1999, the commission issues Mass Media Docket 9925. And what's interesting about this, you've probably seen some of the talk that RecNets and has been putting out. They're proposing an LP250 class. And a couple years ago, we mentioned that in one of these, and I believe I had an article in radio where we talked about it as well. Well, the commission, when they originally proposed it, they had 10, 100, and 1,000 watts. Okay, so there's a big difference between what we have now and what was originally proposed. So the 250 would be kind of a middle ground between them. The other original proposal deleted the second and third adjacent provisions, saying that they were unnecessary. Now, this goes back, some of you may remember, if you've been around long enough, there are, prior to 1964, there were no second and third adjacent protections on full powers, okay, which is why a lot of full power Bs in older cities are going to be short-spaced to adjacent guys. Of course, intense lobbying takes place on both sides, okay? All right, 2000, we get our first, the LPFM service is created. 2001, we get the first window. LCRA shows up in 2010. That gets rid of the third adjacent, more or less, and makes way for the new window, which happened in 2013. Of course, we all remember that. And then here we are today with the proposal for the LP250 class. All right, so interference, just to remember, the simplest definition of interference is a ratio of a desired to an undesired or undesired to desired signal. It really doesn't matter what the field strength is. If you exceed that particular ratio, then you're going to have a problem. All right. So this number that we use of like 60 dBU for full power FMs, there's nothing really magical about that in terms of interference other than it's just a nice signal level and the numbers are nice on it. So even a city grade, even if you're in a city grade area, you could receive interference depending on how high the offender is, their field strength is relative to yours. And in the commission's current definition, we look at this plus and minus three channels, and then we also look at plus and minus 53 and 54. That's our intermediate frequency split, the 10.7 megahertz. Okay, and looking at interference, I kind of boil it down to we kind of have two primary ways that we're going to look at considering it. First, a simple contour overlap. That's pretty easy. Draw some circles. Do they overlap? If they do, then we consider that we have interference. The other way we can do it is with an actual U to D study or an undesired to desired ratio study. And in doing this, it takes a little bit more effort, but it actually gives you a real-world picture of what's going on. And interestingly enough, for full-power FMs, we look at just the contours now, just the overlap. But prior to the early 80s, we actually considered looking at things in terms of the actual interference. So in terms of the overlap, we're looking just at the straight FCC contours. We all know that in this part of the world, those work out pretty well because the terrain's pretty flat, pretty average. Go to Utah, not so much. Yeah. Art knows all about that. Exactly. So the terrain's going to skew things considerably. The other thing is when we get to very, very flat areas like seacoast, we tend to find that the contours fall apart as well. The reality of it is they were defined for an elevation change of about 50 meters. So once you start diverging from that number, we start seeing they fall apart. Now, within the DDU ratios type of study, we can do that under a couple of different flavors. So I'm going to give you just kind of an example here. This would be looking at a DDU study with a couple of contours. So what I've got is I've got an undesired signal up there to the upper left, which is U, oddly enough, and a desired signal to the lower right. So what we'll do is we'll create our protective service contour for the desired signal. In this particular case, it was this is a Class A, and it would be 6 kilowatts at 100 meters. I just assumed a circle for it. And our undesired guy is going to be a co-channel. All right, so that would be the 40 dBu 5010. So there's our contour overlap. So by the standard methodology that we look at nowadays, we would say that area is receiving interference or is predicted to receive interference. Now let's say we go to a U to D study. And if you've ever seen some of the old, like the Channel 6 studies, this should look kind of familiar. What we're going to do, what we did here is we did created a family of curves. And I changed the colors on it slightly. But starting at the blue on the outside, that's 60, and then 40 corresponds there. And every contour we move in, we go up by 1 dB. Okay? So then what we do is we basically play connect the dots. And we start assuming the 60 for the desired guy on the lower right. I guess I have a pointer here, don't I? Since the 60s are protected, we're going to say that coverage is going to stop there, although we know it's not going to. And then where the contours intersect, we're just going to draw a straight line across there and then come back around the contour. So what happens is that gives us an interference area. But look at the difference between the two. This entire area, which was originally the orange area, would be the interference area based on simple contour overlap, versus this area right here, looking at an actual U to D study. So what we can see is when we're talking about actual contour overlap, there's a little bit of extra slop built into it, and actually a little bit of a buffer that prevents some of the anomalies in terrain and things like that. Okay, another way we can do a U to D ratio study is using the free space equations. I'm not going to throw a lot of math, but we got to have a little bit in here, otherwise it wouldn't be one of mine. So in doing this, what we're going to look at is we're going to establish a desired field strength. Now, what that field strength is going to kind of depend on what we're looking for. If we're looking at like a second or adjacent, we're looking for that ratio. We don't really care what the field strength is. We just need to find out what it is where the translator is. So we look at our ratio plus a desired. That's our target interference field strength. And what happens on this is we wind up having a three-dimensional interference region, if you can think about it, kind of a blob in space that's a function of the antenna pattern and the number of bays we have, the spacing, et cetera. So here's our first equation. So we're going to talk about the calculated power density here. And we're going to set that as equal to the quotient of the electrical field strength squared over the free space impedance. Everybody remember what free space impedance is? 377. What's the exact number, though? 120 times pi. So our electric field intensity, this is going to be our base target field strength that we're looking for. Okay. Now, most of the times we look at stuff in terms of like dBu and that, so we have to do some conversions here because this number, our S value, or E value here is actually in terms of volts per meter, which is a pretty high number, obviously. There we are here, 120 pi. Okay, what we can also say is we can also set the power density equal to this equation here. All right? And here, once again, we have our power density. Now, what's interesting about here, we have to remember, is that this is for an isotropic radii, or a point source. So when we're talking about a regular antenna, we have to figure in the dipole factor. R is our distance in meters, and then 4 pi, of course, because it radiates out in a sphere. So here's the conversion. Remember, we have to multiply our power by 2.15, or add 2.15 dB, or multiply by 1.64. What we can do then is we just take both of these equations and combine them to solve for R. So then what this does is this gives us the distance to where our interfering field strength is that we're looking for. Now remember, our antenna pattern is going to cause P to vary. The amount of power is going to vary depending on what your depression angle is off of that antenna. More bays we have, what are we going to do? We're going to squeeze things into a narrow pencil width beam up closer to horizontal. Obviously, a single bay is going to radiate very broadly. So the depression angle, of course, is also going to change our radius to where this field strength is. So what we can do is use trigonometry to solve it. Basically, we're forming a right triangle here. Your distance to the interference field strength is the hypotenuse. We just need to find the other two legs. If you want to do it really quick and dirty and easy, you can use this equation down here at the bottom. So if you ever want to check and consider something quick, if you think you got a problem, just remember that value right there. Once again, R is in meter. P is in watts. You don't have to convert it there. But remember, it's volts per meter. So if we're looking at dBu, we've got to correlate it. Here's an example of what that would do. Now, I just picked a couple of antennas. The one that's on top should be pretty obvious. That's a single bay antenna. Not a plug here, but that's actually the pattern for a 6812, a Shively 6812, which is a fairly common antenna used in translators and that type of thing, low power applications. The second one is what happens if we add a second bay and what that does to the shape of the pattern. So you can see if we look at the top one, this is calculating where our particular interference, and I just picked a number and used it. But what we can see is our interference region falls here. And look here, this is where ground level is. So we can see that we're actually well below ground level. So this would be a problem, okay? The low power guys, we can use this, translators can use this to show no interference to full powers. That's why I'm showing it. But what we can do is with a very simple change here, by adding a second bay to it, we can now shove this interference level above ground. And here's actually ground elevation here. So you can see we're basically no closer than about 10 meters above ground, which would fit in any kind of a residential environment, generally speaking. All right, one of the other ways we can do it too, and this gives you kind of the real world, this is a terrain dependent, and I want to show you why the contours in that here real quick, why they kind of fall apart. This was a construction permit over in Western Illinois that I looked at for a client, and the way the map works here is that any of these gray areas, the signal level is below 48 dBu or half millivolt. If it's white, it's at least 48 dBu. And then the colored areas correspond to these guys over here, and are predicted interference in areas where the signal level is above a half millivolt. And what's interesting about it is that we've got these two guys right up here, these two low powers, which are up here. And you can see if we use a 48 dBu threshold, which is a listenable signal, it's getting noisy, but it's a listenable signal, we've got some predicted interference. But lo and behold, here's our 60 dBu, or our protected contour off the station, and the corresponding, what would be the 54 dBu contours off the low power guys. So there's quite a bit of separation between the predicted between the protected areas, but yet we've got some interference up here, okay? And I think that if you've had translator encroachment, you'll see that, and even full power encroachment, you're going to see that the spacings don't really keep you protected from interference. The black ring that I just added there, that's the spacing requirement. So we can see also, once again, that our LP guys are outside of the spacing requirement. They meet the commission's rules, but we still have an area of predicted interference. Now, in this particular case, it may not be an area that's very crucial, but in some cases, it could be a high population area, especially if you have a station that's a rim shot into a densely populated area. And there's a first adjacent or a second adjacent low power FM there, you could wind up seeing problems in a localized area. And here's just a more detailed shot of it. You can see here that what's happening is the terrain actually is taken into account, because we've got this little pocket here on the west side of the Mississippi where we have interference. And that's because the signal levels come up. Down here, we're along the river, so we're below the bluff. And then we come up on the other side here. All right, so what I did here then was, let's take a look at it in terms of the actual contour. So I plotted the 48 dBU contour. And remember, we talked about interference being a ratio, so we're the 42 dBU now would be, it's because it's a 6 dB ratio on a first adjacent. Well, now all of a sudden, we've got some overlap here. So that starts to make sense. Up here, on the green guy up there, they're close to being tangential. There's a little bit of separation, but we still have some interference that shows up. Bottom line is, just because the spacings and the contours say there isn't going to be any, we know that that's not necessarily the case. Once again, the black circle is our spacing requirement. Just take it a step further. This is looking at a receiver threshold of 54 dBU. That's a half millivolt. I said 48 was at 0.25, beg your pardon. This would be a half here, and you can see if we lower or increase the receiver threshold, then obviously the interference drops off. So it depends on what we want to use as a particular model as to whether there's actual interference. Take it to the 60, and look at that. We've compressed it even further. Okay, so as I mentioned, our terrain-dependent models are going to be our best estimation of what's really taking place. Because we're going to evaluate the signal level of each cell. We're not just going to look at an average across, an average of an average, so to speak. So I mentioned the contours are going to fall apart in unusual terrain. The other thing you got to remember, too, is when we talk about these values for the LPFMs, for instance, licensed at 100 watts at 30 meters, that 30 meters is an average of an average. So we're taking an average of the 8 cardinal radials and their averages. So if we're saying 30 meters there, you could have half the radials at 60 meters and half at zero type of thing to get it to come out at the same value. So the terrain can severely distort. Longley Rice, we've talked about this in previous years, that's probably the most widely used model. It's pretty well proven, and I think we've got a lot of empirical evidence that shows that it's pretty accurate. Okay, technical criteria for our LP guys. Remember, the LP10 class was eliminated. That was originally proposed, but it was eliminated here a couple of years ago. So right now, the only LP stations that we have are the 100-watt version. As I mentioned, it's a maximum of 100 watts at 30 meters above average terrain. And what that does, that gives you a 60 dBU contour distance of 5.6 kilometers. And that's the threshold that we look at. Even on a Class D's, just as a side note, if you take a Class D and move it up to a Class A, that 5.6 is the cutoff value. But interestingly enough, they have a minimum value associated with them as well, and that's 50 watts at 30 meters, or the equivalent thereof. That gives you about 4.7 kilometers for a contour distance. Like always, we have to put an upper bound on everything, so the absolute minimum ERP is going to be 1 watt. The commission specifically states they're not going to authorize any stations with less than a watt. And corresponding to that is height above average terrain of 450 meters, which I don't know if that would be a real practical kind of facility, because you're looking at something outside town in a probably somewhat urban area, rural area, maybe someplace like Denver or something, but still those kind of sites sit out quite a ways. Okay, this is a spacing table that the commission actually has in the rules, and I want to show you a couple of interesting things about it. So what this does, this table, of course, gives us the minimum spacings between an LPFM station and a facility of another class, like always. It also provides a minimum spacing for no received interference. I wanted to be redundant there. Sorry about that. These guys right here. And basically what this is an informational number to the low-power FM station saying, okay, you got to be X distance away, but if you don't want to have any interference from the full power guy, this is actually the separation that you need to maintain. The standard ratios are 40, 54, and 100 are used here to calculate this, but there's also a buffer built into the spacing table, and this gives us the break for the terrain anomalies and things like that. So let's take a look how that works. Let's take, as an example, we'll use a co-channel Class A facility. So our required spacing is going to be 67 kilometers. Class A protected contour is 60 dBu, 50-50, or 1 millivolt. And our LPFM, remember, is 40 dBu, 50-10. So there's that 20 dB ratio. So we're looking at a distance of 52.1 if you actually sum those two together. 28.3 is going to be your distance to the 60 dBu, and 23.8 is the distance to the LPFM interfering contour. And so with that, we get a sum of 52, obviously, which gives us a spacing buffer of about 15 kilometers. Okay. Now let's go to a first adjacent situation. This I did a C3 just because the numbers are nice because we're using the 1 millivolt again. So our required spacing is 67, oddly enough. The protected contour, once again, is a 60. And since we're looking at a first adjacent, we have a 6 dB ratio. So our LPFM is going to be the 54. Okay. Come up with 49 kilometers if you add the two of them together. So we've got a spacing buffer here of 18. All right. So on the first adjacent, there's a little bit built in to accommodate as well. Now, you guys think there's a buffer on second adjacent? Anybody? Thoughts? Well, as it turns out, there actually isn't one on the second. And that probably makes sense that there isn't one, because when we're talking about a second adjacent, we're looking at a 40 dB ratio, which is pretty significant. And so for a low-power FM station, that's going to be a highly localized signal. So trying to impose a buffer on that probably doesn't make a lot of sense. So you can see on, once again, I did an A here, and this is a second adjacent. Our spacing requirement's 29. Same contours, once again. That should be 100, sorry about that. You can see we come out right on the number there. Right on the number. So there's no buffer at all. Now, on the translator side, some of you guys have translators that you have to deal with. Okay. Translators, once again, they always get the short end of the stick, and it's no different here. So let's assume that we have a translator that has a contour radius of 13.3 kilometers. So we've got a spacing requirement of 39 kilometers here. And if it's co-channel LPFM, they're 23.8. There's only a 2 kilometer buffer there, okay? But what happens if we move down a tenth of a kilometer and go to 13.2 kilometer radius? Well, now look at that. Translators actually get the short end of the stick by about 5 kilometers. Okay. So once again, the translators are getting to the short end of the stick. And keep in mind, I mean, the translators for AM, I think it's a great idea, and this is an editorial comment, obviously. It's helped everybody immensely. Ultimately, I think it's probably a Band-Aid. What we need to be heading towards is the all-digital type of FM stuff. And I know it'll give Tom a lot of business. Okay, interference. Difference with translators and the LPFM, and I decided to throw this in even though the idea was originally to talk about full power, just because I do think it's relevant. Translators don't have the benefit of using spacings. We have to look at contours or U to D ratio to LPFMs or to the full power guys. And so the interference situation with an LPFM is not a two-way street. They could meet the spacings and be fine, but then if we try and move a translator, there's already contour overlap there, so you wouldn't be able to exacerbate or change it. So if you do have a translator, you want to be careful of this and watch this to make sure that you don't have some encroachment by some of the LPFM, because if you do want to move it in the future, that could pose a problem. Now, we're outside the LPFM windows. They're still building them right now. Some of that's going to be running out before too long. Generally, they're constrained to the same type of requirements that the full powers are, no movements other than, you know, plus and minus three, that. Unless there's an interference problem, then they can go to any channel they want. So if you have some translators in your area, you might want to take stock of if there are any LPFMs around and just make sure that, you know, everybody knows that you're there and what's going on. Okay, for the full powers, though, there is some way that we can get around the interference, but they're very, very limited. So even though the low-power FMs are a quasi-secondary service, they have more rights than the translators do, once again, because the translators get the short end of the stick. To address or to alleviate interference to a full power, you're looking at a situation where the interference has to be occurring within your city grade contour. Okay? or within the community license. That goes without saying. The commission's still pretty adamant about protecting the community of license. And in reality, that's really all they care about. What happens outside the community ultimately, you know, too bad would be kind of the blunt way of putting it. Another way that you can use this also is instead of having the first two are going to be actual interference, the second one is going to, or the third one rather, is going to be, you can look at some predicted if there looks like there's going to be a problem. 73215 is that rule provision that allows us to contour protect full powers. And so if you're looking at a predicted situation in your city of license where there could be interference by those techniques, you may have some remediation. Interestingly enough, we also have an IF protection, and here it's the 91 dBU contour. For the full powers, that's just a pure spacing. Okay, third adjacent protections, just as a reminder, they are there, sort of. You don't have to meet the spacing requirements. The LPFMs don't have to meet the spacing requirements, but if there is actual interference taking place, it has to be addressed. They also cannot cause interference to translator or booster inputs. And this is actually one of the things that must be certified to on a 318 form. The commission actually puts a 3-minute suspension into, which is kind of a quick number, quick amount of time. But if they are notified of problems on a third adjacent, they have 3 minutes to go off. There's a specific section in the rules about the translator inputs. We'll talk about that here in just a minute. And then the big thing that the third adjacent was there to do was to protect the reading for the blind services. There's not a lot of those out there, but every once in a while you do come across them. Okay, so the translator input protection applies when there's a third adjacent LPFM in the vicinity. No LPFMs within 2 kilometers of the translator if he's transmitting on the same frequency the translator uses as an input. Okay, and additionally, if the LPFM is going to be within plus and minus 30 degrees of a direct line to the primary signal, that spacing goes out to 10 kilometers. That's 827. Now, there are some ways around that. You can show that if the U to D ratio is less than 34. Remember, when we're talking a second or a third adjacent, it's a plus 40 ratio. So what the commission's basically saying there is, hey, if the LPFM is less than half of the field strength that is predicted to cause interference, then they're going to assume everything's okay. You can also do it if you comply with this equation here, which basically gives you a distance number. And in this, we're factoring in the gain of the receive antenna and the gain in the direction of the primary station and then what the field strength of the primary station is. So as long as you exceed that number, the LPFM exceeds that, they're okay. And once again, just to reiterate that, within plus and minus 30. Okay, I guess that's about all I've got. I've got any questions or anything like that can answer? Art. Devin, Art was asking, as Art Reese asked, if I have an abstract. I can send you the PowerPoint if you want. Yeah, just shoot me an email so I remember it and I'll send it to you. Okay, anybody else? John. Say again, John.
Our translator smart is working really good since you figured it out.
Oh, good. Thank you. I appreciate it. Okay, anybody else? Dale.
This always takes a long time and is a sticky issue. Let's say that a high-powered or regularly licensed station has a problem with low power. You got to file. First of all, you want to notify the low power station. They disagree with you. Then you go through all the rigmarole with the FCC. That can take damn near forever and cost a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah.
So if somebody's going to be a real pain in the you-know-what, this can just drag on and the interference continues, correct?
Yeah, exactly. And there are a couple ways around that. As I mentioned, you know, typically you're prevented from moving, more than 3 channels. Now, the rules do allow the LPFM guys to do if there's actually an interference. So in that particular type of situation, probably what would behoove both parties would be to get together and say, hey, we got a problem here. How can we resolve this? And if the full power and the LPFM both go to the commission and say, look, there's a problem here. We need to change this channel, the commission is going to say, fine. Now, where that comes into a problem is places like, oh, Chicago, you know, there isn't any spectrum available. And so in that particular case, then, you know, maybe it's a case of we just got to sort of deal with it, you know. And unfortunately, that's kind of the rub. Obviously, anytime we've got a finite resource, we run up against those walls sometimes. But that's a good point. And the thing is, once again, back to the translators getting the short end of the stick, those guys are secondary too, and the rules specifically state you can't continue operating. But I can tell you, I know of several cases here in the upper Midwest where there have been interference complaints filed, and they're still operating. So it takes a while for the commission to get around to doing it, because ultimately the philosophy, I think, in Washington is you guys work it out on something like that. We don't really want to get involved if we don't have to, because somebody's going to lose. Okay, anybody else? Tom.
Jeremy, I just wanted to ask a question. thank you. We have a situation where low-power FM was put on the air in one of three cities that are the Tri-Cities that are like 20 miles from each other in a triangle.
Right.
And the question was whether they could put translators in the other two cities.
The short answer to that is sort of. Yeah. Remember, this will be a little bit verbose. The low-power FM, by virtue of it being a non-commercial type of station, does not have that protected contour limitation like the full-power guys do. So in other words, the translators for a low-power, I mean, it doesn't make sense to have a fill-in translator for a low-power with only a 5-kilometer radius. So we would assume any translator for a low-power is not going to be a fill-in. And translator of low powers are allowed to translate. The question is, and you got me on this one because I don't remember I believe there's a cap on the number they can have, but it escapes me right now exactly what that is. I don't know if they're going to be able to do all three, but certainly they would probably be able to do one. Now, the other thing that comes into play on this is, the low-power FM station, is he in the non-com part of the band or is he in the commercial part of the band?
He's in the commercial part of the band.
Okay, because then if it's in the commercial part of the band, what do we know about signal delivery to translators? The translator is going to be in the commercial part of the band. What do we know about the signal delivery on that? Yeah, it's got to be off the air. It's got to be off the air. So unless they're able to receive the signal directly, it's going to be an illegal feed scheme. Now, if the translator is in the non-com part of the band, we don't have that requirement. And then, of course, if it's a fill-in, you can use any terrestrial method. Does that answer, I hope?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Sorry.
Told you it was going to be verbose, guys. Sorry about that. All right, anybody else? All right. Well, either I explained it really well or you guys had a lot of carbs for lunch and you're on a food coma. So, thank you very much. I appreciate it.